Okay, well, tonight we're going to pick up where we left off last time in talking about the church at Antioch. And I'll give a quick overview of what we talked about last time and then pick it up. If you have your outline, you can see where I cut it off there the people. So tonight's message, we'll pick it up with the people. Last time we talked about the titles and just kind of why I wanted to talk about this. Of course, it flows out of something from Sunday morning sermon 2 weeks ago when we were talking about Joseph and talking about discerning God's will. That was how I got off on this, because the church in Antioch was trying to find God's will. And specifically, the Lord told them, Barnabas and Saul, set them apart for the ministry that I've called them to, the work that I've called them to do. And so I thought, well, let's look a little deeper at this church at Antioch, and it'll give us a greater understanding of kind of church in general and what we're supposed to be about as the church. And this, you know, why this church matters, the Antioch church, it ends up being a very prominent church in the New Testament. I mean, you typically think Jerusalem. Okay, that's kind of where it all started. That's a very prominent church. And later on down the line, you think, you know, Rome, you think the church in Philippi, and I mean all these churches that Paul was affiliated with. But the church in Antioch was extremely used of God in a powerful way. In fact, you know, with the founding of it and when the church in Jerusalem heard about it, is when they had sent Barnabas there to kind of help disciple the believers there. Barnabas sent for Saul, who was in Tarsus at that time, and he brought him to Antioch. And so you remember from this past Sunday, as we started talking about Mark, he ties in with all this too, because he was in Antioch. He was Barnabas' cousin, and on one of their trips to Jerusalem to bring the famine relief, they brought Mark, who was from Jerusalem, back to Antioch with them. That's how he ends up in Antioch and goes on that first missionary journey that didn't go well, at least not for him. And so the church at Antioch is very prominent, extremely missions-minded, I guess you would say. They were the sending church for Paul's missionary journeys. And so we talked about that last time, and really what I focused on last time was these different offices, first of all, that he mentions, these titles in the church, prophets, teachers, end up with missionaries. And the biggest group of all is the church itself, which all of those individuals are a part of the body as well. But we just kind of talked a little bit about how God brings people together, all these different backgrounds. I mean, even in a church like ours, you know, I mean, okay, we're all pretty much similar backgrounds. I mean, if you figure most folks grew up around here or Louisiana or a handful of people that's from further off, but for the most part, we have pretty similar backgrounds, and it's not like we have 50 different countries represented in our church or anything like that. But even at that, we all have different backgrounds in terms of family, in terms of the households we grew up in terms of, you know, how our parents were and what they did for a living. And so it's interesting to see how the Lord will bring people from all these different backgrounds and bring them together in a church, and the reason why they should get along and there should be love in the church is it's all centered around Christ. That's the one thing we have in common. I mean, that's the main thing. I mean, there's so many other things that churches might do that at the end of the day, they're just completely not important. And, you know, even churches might fight about things that don't amount to anything. What matters is Christ and our love for Him. And as I talked about last time, it's not just the fact that we all love Christ, but hopefully we see Christ in each other, which increases the love. If I love Christ and I see you acting like Christ in a gracious manner, well then, you know, there's a love for one another. We also, if we're all Christians, then we should understand grace to the extent of we know what it means to be forgiven. We know that you know what it means to be forgiven, and so we should forgive one another just as God in Christ has forgiven us. All right, so that's the church at Antioch, kind of, you know, why they matter. And we talked about prophets, as you see on your list there. And I talked a little bit about true versus false prophets and Old Testament versus New Testament and predictive versus present-day prophets. I mean, some prophets would say, okay, in the future, this is going to happen. Some prophets said, all right, this is what God says now. This is what he says you need to do today. And so there's different types of prophecy, but at its just basic definition, a prophet is one who speaks God's word and proclaims, thus saith the Lord. We talked about teachers, and I said, you know, that's a little different because whereas a prophet might exhort, a teacher explains. And, you know, I think of sometimes I like listening to people that, you know, kind of fire you up, if you will. And then sometimes I like listening to someone who I really feel like I come away having learned a lot. You might view that as someone who's more prophetic versus someone who's more of a teacher. Ideally, you get both of that. You know, I mean, like when you prepare a sermon, you want both of that. I mean, you want to certainly, you know, encourage and inspire and whatnot, but you also want that teaching element of, hey, let's dig into God's word and learn something. Of course, missionaries, we talked about Paul and Barnabas in this case, and we talked about kind of that history of the missions movement there, the Great Commission, Pentecost, the persecuted church, which ends up fleeing, and as they flee, they take the gospel, and that's how the gospel starts to fan out. And this is really the first time you see what I would call a missionary in the sense of specifically someone set apart, two people set apart, for the job of going out, leaving their church, going into other lands, and taking the gospel. And then we ended last time talking about Barnabas. As you see on the outline when we got to the people, Barnabas was the only one we talked about. And a very interesting life when you consider Barnabas. Does anybody remember what his real name was? Ah, you know Sam. Sam's like he's the valedictorian of Wednesday night, you know. He knows his stuff. What's that? Yeah. Did you get that from her or she? Yeah. I know you didn't get it from your dad, so you didn't have to. Got to be careful. He's got control of my microphone back there. If I say something he doesn't like, he can cut me off. So, hey, what happened? I shouldn't have given him any ideas, huh? All right, so we talked about Barnabas last time. His real name's Joseph. He's from Cyprus, which is an island. He is a Jew in terms of his heritage. And the reason he's called Barnabas in the Bible is because the apostles gave him that name as a nickname. It means son of encouragement. So his real name was Joseph. But sometimes nicknames stick, and Barnabas' nickname stuck. And I think you see why as you read about him. When he is mentioned in the New Testament, he's very encouraging. I mean, he's the one that brings Paul into the church when they were scared of him, you know, after Paul was converted. I mean, he comes along, brings him along. He brings John Mark along. He brings him along on the missionary journey. That goes horrible. John leaves, and then when they get ready to do the second one, he wants to bring him along again. This guy's so encouraging that he starts to get on Paul's nerves because Paul's like, he's not going. And Barnabas says, he is going. And, of course, they split. I talked about that Sunday as well. And the last thing I'll mention from last time was on Barnabas, I'd mentioned the fact that usually, I mean, every Christian has weaknesses. Some of them we're blind to, some of them we know we have, all right? You know, like I can tell my wife, for example, and she already knows this because I've said this to her before. Whatever weaknesses you think I have, most of them I know about, all right, in terms of my spirituality. She knows about them better than anyone because she lives with me. And so if she were to say to me, Shane, you know, you struggle a little bit with this. I don't think she's ever said anything to me like that that would have surprised me because I would say, yeah, I know I do. I shoot my mouth off too much. Yes, I know I do. We all have weaknesses. And so when I know I have a weakness, the inclination for a Christian, now a non-Christian is going to say, well, I don't care, that's just how I am, live with it. Well, now a Christian, that shouldn't be your attitude. I mean, if you're talking about something that's sinful is what I'm talking about. If I have a sinful weakness where, you know, as a Christian, I want to work on it, right? I want to do better. Well, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be hurtful. I don't want to be harsh, things like that. And so we try to correct. And in Barnabas's case, what I think happened was that he corrected, and he corrected too far, which is why he got in trouble in Galatians 2. that's where Peter was friendly with the Jew or with the Gentile Christians until the Jews came, and then he began to back off. And you remember Paul says, I confronted him to his face because he stood condemned. And he mentions this, even Barnabas was led astray by the hypocrisy. Now that was a type of sin. I mean, this is a sin. They are misrepresenting the gospel in what they're doing. It was the type of sin that you would never expect Barnabas to do, because it was a sin of being too judgmental. And he's not that way. He's usually the other way. He's usually so encouraging that Paul says, look, we got to take a stand on John Mark. The gospel's at stake here. Not that John Mark was a false teacher, but that he's not up for the task of being a missionary. And so with Barnabas, it's like, okay, you know, he had a run-in with Paul, and, you know, maybe he'd run in with the Jerusalem church over Paul because they thought he was too gracious toward Paul. A lot of times Barnabas is in the right, but sometimes he's in the wrong. Now, if he tries to correct that, then he comes over here and he's like, you're right, I'm too soft. Oh, we can't be hanging out with those Gentiles. I mean, we don't want to offend the Jews. And so whatever happens, Paul, he's not going to stand for it, and he doesn't. And he mentions in Galatians 2, even Barnabas was led astray. Now, that's my take on why Barnabas was led astray. At least one reason why was that he self-corrected a little too far there. All right, so we ended with Barnabas, and tonight we pick it up with Simeon, who is the next one mentioned. Now, bear in mind, again, these are teachers, prophets that are in Antioch. So they're teaching, they're leaders in the church at Antioch. And the Bible mentions who they are. Barnabas is mentioned first. As I said, he came from Jerusalem, and so he's probably considered a pretty prominent teacher there. The next one here, Simeon, it tells us, Simeon, who is also called Niger. Now, Niger means, the word means black, and so that would indicate he was probably from Africa. Now, when you think of that, you try to figure out who he is, okay? We don't know. I mean, maybe he's just a guy that was originally from Africa that lived in Antioch and he became a teacher in the church. However, this is something that I find very fascinating. Is when you think about, you begin to dig and you begin to study, you say, okay, Simeon, also called Niger, probably from Africa. Simeon is a derivative of the name Simon. Okay, it's the same name. It's like Bob and Bobby or something. It's the same name, Simeon, Simon. Okay, well, there's other Simons in the Bible, of course. Simon Peter, and, you know, there was a Simon the magician. You can think of another Simon. Simon of Cyrene. It's exactly where I'm going, in fact, because Cyrene, does anyone know where it's located? Africa. It is. It's northern Africa, Libya. And so Simon of Cyrene was another man in the Bible named Simon / Simeon from Africa. And so you start to wonder, is that Simon? Is that the guy that carried Jesus' cross that's at the church at Antioch? Well, we don't know. It could be, it might not be, but when you figure his name's the same, he's from the same region at least, it's interesting to pursue that as a possibility. You check the commentators and you know how it is. It's half of them say, yeah, it probably is, and half of them say, no, it's probably not. We don't know. It doesn't say specifically, you know. So it's kind of guessing. But let me give you a couple of verses that tell us about Simon of Cyrene, of course, the one who was pressed into service to carry the cross. First of all, bear in mind Cyrene had a very active Jewish population, and Simon of Cyrene was a Jew, and he's coming to Jerusalem. I mean, he wasn't coming to watch the crucifixion. He's just coming, and he gets pressed into service, and so I mean, it's all fascinating from a sovereignty of God perspective, particularly if Simon of Cyrene becomes a believer and even a leader in the early church. This guy's just happening along to Jerusalem, and some Roman soldier grabs him and says, you carry the cross. And now the guy's going to heaven. Not because he carried the cross, but because he's elect. He was chosen to do more than just carry the cross. He's chosen unto salvation. it would seem. Here's what Mark records about Simon carrying the cross. Mark 15:21. They pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. Now, some have pointed out, and I think this is a very good point, why does Mark mention the names of his two sons? What would be the point in that? I mean, who cares what his sons are named? Unless that's significant to the people that Mark is writing to. Mark is writing, presumably, to the church in Rome or to Christians in Rome. And so the understanding that many take from that is that Alexander and Rufus are probably well known in the church at Rome. And therefore, when Mark's writing this gospel and he says, oh, the guy who carried the cross, Simon of Cyrene, is the father of Alexander and Rufus, and you guys know him, so you know who I'm talking about. Well, that's very interesting. And then when you continue on, you say, okay, well, who's Alexander and Rufus? Does the Bible say anything about them? Yeah, maybe, maybe not. I mean, there's a couple of Alexanders mentioned, some good, some bad. Alexander the coppersmith was not a very nice guy, probably a different Alexander. There was also an Alexander that was a traveling companion of Paul's, it seems. But this is interesting. Rufus is the other brother, the son of Simon of Cyrene. Romans chapter 16, verse 13, this is Paul, of course, at the end of the letter. He says, greet Rufus, a choice man in the Lord. Also greet his mother and mine. His mother and mine. Now, if you just kind of loosely do the math here as best I can. All right, so Simon of Cyrene is the guy that carried the cross for Christ. He had two sons, Alexander and Rufus, both of whom might have been Christians in the Roman church. That's why Mark mentions them. And, of course, Paul, too, is writing the letter of Romans to who? The Romans. And he mentions Rufus. So it's the same Rufus, it appears. And what does he say about this Rufus? He says, greet him and also his mother, who is also mine. Now, what he means by that is she's like a mother to me, which means Simon of Cyrene's wife was like a mother to Paul. At least that's how that kind of sounds. That, to me, that is fascinating to see the providential hand of God at work that would bring these people together. Paul, the guy who wanted to destroy Christianity, who hated Jesus, who was there when Stephen was being martyred, and Simon of Cyrene, who carried Jesus' cross, and it seems pretty early on, became a Christian. These two end up, their households it seems, so close that Paul would describe Simon's wife as like a mother to him. Fascinating when you consider the fear that the early church had of Paul after he was converted. He's going to need some mother-like figures. You know? He's going to need somebody to kind of take him in, and it seems as though maybe Simon of Cyrene played a hand in that. All right, so that's Simeon. Is that the same Simeon as Simon of Cyrene? It might be, it might not be, we don't know, but it's interesting. Even if it's not the same one, that whole little aspect of Simon of Cyrene and his sons and, you know, Rufus's mother and the closeness to Paul, that's all pretty solid information, which is interesting. All right, so the next one, after Simeon, we see Lucius. Lucius, who is that? Well, notice this, which gives a little more credence to my previous theory. Where's he from? Cyrene! Looky there! And so right there in the list, you've got Simeon called Niger from Africa, and then Lucius from Cyrene, which is also Africa. And so that might indicate that they're both from the same region. Now, the men of Cyrene were pretty prominent. As I said, they had a very active Jewish community in Cyrene. And it seems many of them embraced Christ. Many of them became Christians and were even active in the missions movement. Acts chapter 11, verse 19, it says this, meanwhile, those scattered by the persecution that began with Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, speaking the message only to Jews. But some of them, men from Cyprus and Cyrene, went to Antioch and began speaking to Greeks as well. Okay, so men from Cyprus, who's from Cyprus? Barnabas. And Cyrene, who's from there? Simon, Simeon, yeah, Lucius. This sounds like the same group of people that all end up at Antioch, and it tells us they went to Antioch. So this is probably, when it says men from Cyprus and Cyrene went to Antioch, it's probably talking about these very same people, began speaking to the Greeks as well. Okay, well, how's that going to go? Initially, they were just talking to the Jew first and also to the Greek, and they say, you know what, let's start proclaiming the gospel to the Greeks as well. Okay, well, how's that going to go? They were proclaiming the good news about the Lord Jesus. The hand of the Lord was with them, so it went well. The hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number of people believed and turned to the Lord. Isn't it amazing how things end up working out exactly how God says they're going to work out? You're going to take the gospel to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Well, who's going to be saved? Jews and Greeks. All of them? Nope. But some from both camp, both groups. And that's what ends up happening. Okay, so who's Lucius? Well, we don't know. Again, there is another Lucius that's mentioned with Paul in Corinth when he writes Romans. When he writes to the Romans and he says, greet Rufus, because Rufus is with you guys in Rome, he also mentions Lucius and he says, he's with me, he sends his greeting. So he's in Corinth with Paul. That's where he wrote Romans from. And the only other Lucius or Lucius or anything along those lines that we know of in the Bible would be Luke, the beloved physician. Is this talking about Luke? I don't know. Could be. But probably not, because this Lucius is from Cyrene, and Luke the physician, the Bible, I don't think ever says where he's from, but he was believed to be from Antioch. So, I mean, he could be there, but that's probably not him, because he's probably not from Cyrene. All right, let's move on to Manaen. This one is fascinating. When you just look at it, and read what it says about him. It doesn't say much, but what it says is incredible. Manaen, who had, verse 1 still, Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch and Saul. Saul's a separate one there. So Manaen, what do we know about him? The only thing we know is that he was brought up with Herod. Well, that's a pretty big deal. For this guy to be a Christian, he was brought up with Herod, and it tells us which Herod, Herod the Tetrarch, that tells us which one he's talking about. That would be Herod Antipas, which was the one, the Herod, that John the Baptist confronted, okay? Which means he's also the one that John the Baptist beheaded, okay? Which means he's also the one that mocked Jesus. This is the Herod. And when Jesus was on trial before Pilate, and Pilate said, oh, no, he's from Galilee, now get rid of him, send him to Herod. This is the Herod. And he goes to him, and he mocks him, and he ridicules him, and Jesus doesn't say anything to Herod, and they send him back to Pilate. Well, Manaen, who is a teacher, a leader in the Antioch church, grew up with that same Herod. In fact, it's not like, I'll put it in modern day terms, it's not like they went to high school together, it's closer than that. Because the word used here, it says brought up with, okay? The Greek word there is syntrophos, which means to be nourished together, to mature together, to be fed together. It's a word that is used frequently to describe someone who is a foster brother. Or an adopted brother, someone that grows up in the same household even. So to me, that's very, very interesting and telling to consider. He becomes a leader in the early church. He grew up as Herod's brother, almost. I mean, for all intents and purposes, that's what this passage is saying. He was like a brother to Herod. Mean Herod. Herod that mocked Jesus. So you think about that. You know, these two grow up in the same household. And one is so wicked that he plays a hand in the crucifixion. And he really, Herod's the one that turned it ugly in terms of the mocking and whatnot. Just a rotten man as it pertains to Christianity, and his brother, so to speak, foster brother, best friend, whatever he was, grew up in his household. he not only becomes a Christian, but one of the prominent leaders in one of the most prominent churches in Antioch. And so it's fascinating, again, to see the hand of God at work and how he brings these churches together, how he brings these people together. Okay, and one other point on Menahem, if he's like a brother to Herod Antipas, that also would assume that he would be in the same household as Herod the Great. So like a, was he like a son to Herod the Great? Herod the Great's the one that tried to kill Jesus when he was a baby. So Menahem didn't exactly grow up in a Christian home. That's my point. I mean, Herod. Ugh. And God saved him. Isn't that incredible? I mean, when you consider that, the astounding aspect of salvation. God saved him. And so this is your church in Antioch. You've got a couple of guys from Africa. You got Barnabas, who's from Cyprus by way of Jerusalem, who is a Jew. You've got Menahem, who, more or less a Roman, grew up in paganism, probably, at least influenced heavily by it with Herod. Yes, Herod was technically a Jew, but he wasn't really a practicing Jew. What an interesting group of people. What do they have in common in their background? Very little. Saul and Barnabas, yeah, they're both Jews. Simeon and Lucius, both from Africa. Menahem, he's just out of left field. What an interesting group that the Lord would bring together. And there's unity here. I mean, they're praying together. They're fasting together. They're seeking the Lord together. And the Lord's speaking to them. Because it's not about them. It's about the Lord. All right, so let's move on to Paul, Saul, as he's called here. Both names are accurate. Many people wrongly believe that Saul changed his name to Paul when he became a Christian. That's not technically true. His name was both. I believe Sergius Saulus Paulus is how it is in Greek. So both would have been his names. And it's a couple of places in the Bible it just says Saul, who was also called Paul. And so, I mean, he was still called Saul in some circles, no doubt. But it wasn't like, because I've heard people say, oh, I'm a Christian now, I'm going to change my name just like Saul did. Well, Saul didn't change his name. It was already his name. So if you want to change your name, it's your business. But you can't really say you're doing it because Paul did it, because Paul didn't do it. All right, so Paul's road to salvation. I mean, you know Paul's story. Everybody does. But just a little bit of refresher on it. Okay, he's born a Roman Jew. What is a Roman Jew? That is an odd mixture, but it's a very beneficial mixture in that culture. He's a Jew. He is a Jew of Jews, in fact, a Hebrew of Hebrews, a Pharisee. But he's a Roman. Why? What makes him a Roman? Yes, Sam. I'm going to have to start making other people answer. He's born in Tarsus, so that makes him a Jew. He's a Jew by birth. He was born, I mean, it makes him a Roman by birth. You could buy Roman citizenship for a lot of money, but he's a even upper echelon because he was born one. All right, and he's also not only a Pharisee, but his family is Pharisaic. So he's not the only, it's not like he converted to Pharisee. His dad was a Pharisee. His mom was a Pharisee. He tells us this in Acts 23, verse 6, when he's on trial before the Sanhedrin, the council. It says in Acts 23, verse 6, perceiving that one group was Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, plural, which means mom and dad are both Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. Now, we know why he did that, right? Why did he go off on this tangent about the resurrection? Right. So the Pharisees and Sadducees are both there. Paul figures that out, and all of a sudden Paul goes, I'm a Pharisee. I'm here. The only reason they're trying me, they're picking on me. This is fake news. They're picking on me because I hold to the resurrection. Now, he knows what that's going to do. It's going to get them fighting with each other. And the Sadducees, who actually have more power in the Sanhedrin than the Pharisees did, they say, oh, well, you know, he's a heretic, and the Pharisees are like, hey, wait a second. This is all about the resurrection. Well, I believe in the resurrection. I don't see anything wrong with him. It's incredible what Paul did in that little incident there in Acts 23. Well, let me ask you this, though, just out of curiosity. You think of the situation. Paul's on trial, possibly going to be executed, which is always a possibility with this gang of thugs that he's dealing with. It's a tense situation. Paul realizes, okay, Pharisees, Sadducees, they violently oppose one another on the resurrection, so I'm going to bring up that topic. That's a pretty shrewd move on his part. But let me ask you this. When Paul says, I am a Pharisee, present tense, I am a Pharisee, is that right or wrong for Paul to do that? Is he lying? He's a Christian now. So is this, it's kind of an ethical question I'm just throwing out. Is Paul right or wrong to do that within the context? Now, I think we could all excuse it and say, well, you know, I mean, he's fighting for his life here. Who can blame him for saying whatever he has to say? But this is Paul. Is he right or wrong? I am a Pharisee. Is he lying to try to keep from getting killed? And even if he is lying, is it justified under the circumstances? Any thoughts? Right. Right. And so the term Pharisee could mean more than just simply belief system. He no longer holds to what the Pharisees held to. But when he says, personally, I don't think what he did was wrong. I think some people would disagree with me and say, what are you talking about? He was lying. I don't think he was lying. I think he was being very careful in how he stated the truth. And there's a difference, all right? When he says, I am a Pharisee, he's speaking within the context of really nothing more than the resurrection. Because that's the topic he brought up. And within the context of that room made up of Pharisees and Sadducees, he says, I am a Pharisee, son of Pharisees, and I'm on trial today because of the resurrection. And so he qualifies how he's a Pharisee. He's not saying, oh, I embrace everything the Pharisees embrace. He qualifies it. And again, what he's hitting at here more than anything else is his background, because he says, I'm the son of Pharisees. In other words, hey, I'm just like you guys in some ways, all right? The Pharisees. I grew up a Pharisee. I am a Pharisee. It's like me saying I'm an Okie or something. Oh, he's lying. He doesn't live in Oklahoma, but I grew up in Oklahoma, right? So there's a certain extent to which I could always say for the rest of my life, I'm an Okie because that's where I grew up. Just like if you call yourself a Cajun or something, you grow up in Louisiana. Although technically Cajuns were Acadians that came from Nova Scotia, but I won't get into that. So I don't think he's lying, at least not the way he phrases it. I mean, if he got up there and said, you know what, I am a Pharisee and I'm being tried because I believe in the resurrection. Oh, what are your views on Jesus? I reject Christ because I'm a loyal Pharisee. Now, we would totally not be on board with that. That's not what he does. In fact, he's really on trial because he's Christian. The specific resurrection he has in mind when he says, I'm on trial because of the resurrection, is the resurrection of Christ. It's not resurrection in general that they arrested him for. It's the resurrection of Christ. And so again, he's not lying when he says, I'm on trial because of the resurrection. He's just qualifying it, and he's being very careful how he says it. Which I don't see anything wrong with that, particularly under those circumstances. Another aspect of that is to consider if Paul has anything evangelistic in mind. Now, let me ask you this. Did Paul have any kind of heart desire for the Jewish people? We know he did. From where? What passage, generally speaking? Romans 9, Romans 10. My heart's desire for them is that they be saved. I could wish myself accursed for the sake of my kinsmen according to the flesh. Now, if he has any type of evangelistic mindset here as he stands there in the Sanhedrin with Sadducees and Pharisees, he's a Pharisee. Those are his kinsmen. I mean, they're all his kinsmen in the sense of being Jews, but the Pharisees particularly, not only, you know, in terms of family and whatnot, but it really even more than that in terms of ideology, in terms of what they believe. I mean, he's from the same school as them. Now, if he's thinking evangelistically and he says, I am a Pharisee and I'm on trial because of the resurrection of the dead, you have to wonder if he didn't have more in mind as to what he might say to these Pharisees later, had he been allowed to proceed, which he wasn't. What I'm getting at is he might have said to those Pharisees, you know what, I'm a Pharisee slash Jew, and the proper response of a Jew to Jesus Christ would be to embrace him as the Messiah. I mean, isn't that what Paul is? Isn't that what any Jew in the Scriptures who became a Christian, is that not what they are, a Jew that embraced the Messiah, as opposed to rejecting and killing the Messiah? Paul's saying, yes, I am a Pharisee, and as a Pharisee, as a Jew, as soon as the Messiah comes on the scene, I should embrace him, and that's what happened by the grace of God. May it happen to you too by the grace of God. So I'm saying he might have had an evangelistic mindset there, because we know for a fact that he had a tremendous burden for the Pharisees, for the Jews as a whole, but the Pharisees particularly. And so under the circumstances, I think he's justified in what he says. I think he was probably even had a noble motivation for it. Any thoughts on that before I move on? Yeah, Andrew. Right. Exactly, yeah. I mean, he may have been looking for an open door, you know, a door that God is opening. I think people that have the gift of evangelism, sometimes in the Bible, there are people who are evangelists, and I think the name evangelist has really gotten a bad rap, because of televangelists and because of other people like that. I mean, a lot of evangelists that come and do revivals and whatnot are horrendous. I mean, I grew up in the Southern Baptist world, and the Southern Baptist evangelists were atrocious. Not all of them, I don't want to lump them all in, but many of them were like hucksters. I mean, it was anything they could do to guilt you down the aisle and brag about their numbers for how many conversions they had. But a true evangelist, someone that you might say has a gift for it, I think it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with preaching ability. It may not even be someone who's a preacher at all. It's somebody who God has gifted in a certain way that they are discerning as to when God's opening doors for them to share the gospel. I mean, anybody can go out and knock on doors and try to beat the gospel over someone's head, but it takes discernment to realize or to even see kind of a bridge there, you know? You're in a conversation with somebody who's an unbeliever, and you may not have, I mean, you're not just going to go up and say, hey, are you a Christian? Because they're gone. They're not going to go for that. But somehow, in the course of the conversation, and it occurs to you, ooh, this could be a segue for the gospel. Now, I have that happen sometimes because I'm a pastor, but in one sense, people sometimes, the topic of religion will come up easier because I'm a pastor, but in another sense, other people will immediately put up their guard because, oh boy, he's a pastor, here he comes, you know. Which that's not how I am, but just the stigma attached to my profession. I joke all the time that I've got one of the most stigmatized professions there is, with good cause, because most preachers are worthless, in my opinion. I joke with Sid Horn about this all the time because he comes from a profession that's the same way. He's a lawyer. Most lawyers, according to Sid, I'm not saying this, according to Sid, most lawyers are worthless. I say the same thing about preachers. I wouldn't listen to most of them. I wouldn't listen to me unless I just didn't have any other choice. So, all right, so moving on here. Paul, he's a Pharisee. He's raised as a Pharisee. He's raised in Jerusalem. Now, he was born in Tarsus, but he was raised in Jerusalem. Why? Did his dad get a job at the Walmart in Jerusalem, so they had to move? How'd he end up in Jerusalem? Why? Anybody know? Yeah, to sit under Gamaliel, that's what he says in Acts. He said, I was born in Tarsus, but brought up in this city under the teaching of Gamaliel. So, I mean, that's where you went to get the best Jewish education, was to study with the rabbis in Jerusalem. It's interesting because Paul got the best education you could get as far as a Jew. But there's somebody else who was about born around the same time as Paul who didn't have the luxury of a Jewish education, even though he was a Jew, at least not a Jerusalem education. Poor guy had to grow up in Nazareth. You know what I'm talking about? Heard of this guy? Starts with a J. What was it? Yeah. Jesus, that's it. Paul had way more prestigious of a Jewish pedigree than Jesus did. Like I say, the only time Jesus is recorded as having gone to Jerusalem as a child was when he went to the temple. And he went to school, all right, but he went to be the teacher of the rabbis at 12 years old. He went and schooled them, and they marveled. Always makes you wonder if Gamaliel was one of those who was marveling at that. And maybe a seed was planted, because you know in Acts 5, many years later, when the Jews are ready to just destroy Christianity, Gamaliel's the one that stands up and says, I would advise against it. I wouldn't mess with them, because if they're really nothing, they'll fizzle out. If this is of God, you're going to see yourself fighting against God. Now that's a strange thing for a Jew who supposedly rejects Jesus to say, which tells us what? Gamaliel didn't reject Jesus. He at least opened the door to the possibility. He might really be the Son of God. He might really be the Messiah. According to church history, the Bible doesn't say specifically, but according to historians, Gamaliel did in fact become a Christian. Some say that he became a disciple of Paul. Isn't that interesting in God's providence? Paul was brought up at the feet of Gamaliel in Judaism. He's converted, discipled by the Apostle Paul. God is interesting in the way he does things. Okay, so that's Paul, raised in Jerusalem, fierce persecutor of the church, and this is who is brought together in Antioch, this group of people here. And you know, for every one of these leaders that we know a little bit of their story and their background, then you've got a whole church full of people who have, every single one of them has an individual background, has an individual testimony of how the Lord saved them. It's fascinating to see how God does this. And moving on here, in terms of background, I already tied that in with their names. And then the work. What was the work? And we'll wrap it up with this. What was the work that they were doing? It tells us in verse 2, they were ministering to the Lord and fasting, and obviously praying as a part of that, and then sending. Verse 3, when they had fasted and prayed, they laid their hands on them and sent them away. And so that's really, that's what the church is to be about doing. 21st century idea of the church is interesting in the sense of most churches have a laundry list, you know, this long of things that they have to have, or we're not a church. I mean, you can't have a church unless you've got this program and this program and this program and this program and this program. I hit on this last week, and I'm not going to re-preach it, but what were they doing in the early church? Not a whole lot of different things. Praying, fasting, ministry of the word, sending out in terms of evangelism and missions. Acts chapter 2 tells us this in the early church, verse 41. Acts 2, verse 41. So then those who had received the word were baptized. That's one thing you do in a church. And that day there were added about 3,000 souls, and they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching. That's another thing you have to have in a church. And to fellowship, and to the breaking of bread, probably a reference to the Lord's Supper, and to prayer. All right, So that's the early church. What were they doing? Block parties and Bible school and, you know, not that there's necessarily anything wrong with those things. So don't hear me say that. That's not what I'm saying. But to have a church, what do you got to have? Believers who are baptized, the apostles teaching. I mean, that's pretty much the New Testament. In other words, the Bible has to be taught, proclaimed, baptizing believers, fellowship, breaking of bread, which is the other ordinance. You've got baptism, you've got the Lord's Supper, and prayer. You got that? You've got the necessary elements for a church. Well, we got to do this, or nobody's going to come. We got to do this. Listen, if they're not willing to come for those five things, what kind of church do you want? Well, at our church, we preach the word, and we pray, and we fellowship together, and we do the ordinances. Oh, well, I don't want that. Well, then whatever you want is not a church. You want a country club. You want a social club. You want a YMCA. You want something other than a church, because this is what churches do. Now, there's nothing wrong with churches doing other things necessarily, I'm not saying that it's bad. I know some churches do things as outreaches, and that's perfectly fine. That's perfectly good. I'm not saying that outreaches are bad. But the idea that you have to have these certain things, well, it's 21st century, you can't do it like they did in the Bible. Why not? Has God changed? Has the gospel changed? Is how people get saved change? There's some that will argue that today. Oh, yeah, you can't preach to people. I mean, that may have worked years ago. That's old school, though. People aren't going to take that anymore. Now, that betrays an obvious misunderstanding as to how people get saved anyway. If you think you have to do certain things to hoodwink them into the kingdom, you don't even understand the gospel. You certainly don't understand the sovereignty of God nor the depravity of man. Okay, so that's the church in Antioch, and I guess that's all we need to know about them for tonight. And we'll stop there. Any questions, comments?